have another interview for you. This time it comes from a writer, Mick Abrahamson. When he got to speak with A.J. Grandscredden, the creative director and writer on Disney Illusion Island from Lala Studios. In this interview, they talk the past, present, and future of Disney Illusion Island and how the game came to be.
All right, so thank you so much, A.J., for sitting down and chat with me.
No, thank you for taking the time.
I absolutely love Disney Illusion Island. So before we really get into the interview, tell me about yourself and the game.
Where to start? So my role on the project is I'm creative director and writer on the project. I co-wrote it with my writing partner, Kelsey. And Kelsey was one of my writers on Battletoads when we did the 2020 sequel. Illusion Island is just this wonderful experience we got to kind of create and go on this journey for, really, where, you know, it's not every day you get handed Mickey Mouse, Minnie Mouse, Donald Duck and Goofy and get to create a whole new world for them to play in and a whole new bunch of characters for them to kind of interact with. And yeah, it's been an incredibly kind of surreal 3 years of getting to do what is completely a childhood dream.
That is so awesome to hear. And yeah, you touched on, like, this is kind of like a fabled property for many developers to work on. And we've almost not really seen Mickey and Friends really go on this new adventure like this in almost like 10, 20 years. So what was that elevator pitch like to Disney to get not only a Disney property, but the Fab Four and to make it your own?
Yeah, it's really interesting. So we'd worked with Disney back in 2015, 2016. And, you know, just through changes in the industry, kind of that didn't work out. And so we'd kind of gone our separate ways. And we were making Battletoads. It was about late summer 2019. We were starting to try and figure out, okay, like, Battletoads is going to ship next summer. What are we going to do after this? And we almost jokingly said, oh, like, maybe we should chat to Disney. And then we were kind of like, well, why don't we chat to Disney again? So we got on a call together, and it was just this really lovely call where kind of we talked them through how we changed and grown and matured as a studio. They spoke to us about kind of what they were looking to do with their properties now, how they were approaching games. And it just felt like catching up with old friends. And at the end of the call, we kind of said, like, okay, well, like, shall we try and do something together? And, you know, we all kind of agreed, yep. And we were like, we'd love to kind of have a stab at Mickey and Friends. You know, I'm a lifelong Mickey fan. My office is covered in various bits of Mickey memorabilia. And, you know, everyone was on board with that. And so kind of we went away and we started putting together a pitch, and we knew we wanted to do four player. We knew we wanted to do the Fab Four. We very quickly figured out we wanted this challenge of like making a seamless world, like Mickey game. Mm-hmm. And the strange thing is, and I said this recently, is that I don't remember a formal green light. I remember this initial conversation, and I remember lots of back and forth conversations where we were just collaborating on what the game could be. But the next thing I know, we're making the game. Like, I don't ever remember like a big formal green light. I think that kind of speaks volumes to the partnership in general, to be honest. It's just been this really natural feeling collaboration between ourselves and Disney.
That is so awesome to hear. And was there any part of the pitch itself that it was not going to have any combat? Or did that kind of come naturally as the development process came along to create this game?
Yeah, so no, that was never the intention. There was never like, it wasn't like I sat down and was like, hey, we're going to make this game have no combat. In fact, when Grant, our lead designer, and I sat down and started trying to really figure out what could this project be, combat was in it. Like, combat was up on the wall. We covered my office in post-it notes and combat was up there. And we almost avoided the conversation. We dug really deep into all the abilities and what the world could be and the game mechanics. And we almost seemed to deliberately avoid the conversation about combat. I think part of that was because we didn't necessarily fully believe in it. And we kind of let it go for quite a while to the point where we actually prototyped some initial combat bits in terms of like tech built it so you could jump on an enemy's head. And then when design were kind of prototyping out the different types of enemies, we said to them, hey, like, you know, use this how you see fit. Like, you know, put it on enemies if you think it makes sense. Don't feel you have to have it on all enemies. And then we did like 10 or 12 enemies and they used it like once and a half, like two times at most. And Grant and I sat down and we were like, we're almost telling ourselves we don't need combat. Like, we're designing a game that has got the ability to have combat in it and we're not putting it in. Like, why do we want combat? Why is combat still up on the wall? And the only actual answer we had was, oh, well, Metroidvanias traditionally have combat. Like, that was the only reason we had for keeping combat up on the wall, was this concept that because other games had done it, we had to do it. And I think once that clicked, we felt very comfortable throwing the post-it in the bin and kind of stripping what little combat there was in the game out of the game.
So combat was initially like on the ideas. You said that you're making ideas for like all the different gadgets at that time too. Does that mean you had some ideas in mind for different gadgets of combat for each of the characters initially before the post-it went in the bin?
We never really dug deep into that. I think combat for us, when we had it, was very basic. It was your traditional Mario jump on the head style combat.
Okay.
We hadn't kind of thought about like the quack shot route or like throwing apples like the older Mickey games. I think it was like, okay, let's get the basics in. And I think once it became clear to us that it wasn't what we wanted and the basics even felt like too much, we knew not to dig any deeper.
So that's really interesting. And another interesting path, like just starting the game, getting into it and realizing that there is no combat was really kind of a wake up call. Because it didn't really feel like that came across that much in the trailers. It just felt like a really cool Metroidvania game with Mickey and friends getting all these cool gadgets. But another really fun moment in the game, really realizing, was how unique each of the characters were in their own way and getting those gadgets as well. What were your favorite gadgets to make and what really inspired you all to make different gadgets for each of the characters?
Yeah, I mean, that was a ton of fun. Favorite ones to make. Well, I'll start with the inspired us. So one of our key pillars was create a playable cartoon where you play as a cartoon. And that's quite a wordy pillar. But the reason for that amount of words is that when we made Battletoads, one of our pillars was create a playable cartoon. And we felt very confident we did that. And the difference was that when we came to do Illusion Island, is we really wanted to lean into the fact that this was a cartoon about cartoon characters. Like, we didn't want it to be like realistic. I know Battletoads was far from realistic, but there were still some rules that applied. And so we really then looked to kind of define their personalities. What were the personality traits or the running gags we wanted? And we kind of ended up with this, you know, for Mickey, his Fred through his gadgets is very much like very cartoony, giant pencil. You know, it's very much leaning into cartoon tropes. Minnie was all about adventure. You know, Minnie got the carabiner to swing on. She got the pickaxe to climb the wall with. Minnie was about being adventurous. Goofy's all about food, you know, the giant mustard bottle, and, you know, getting the chili pepper for his boost jump. And what we knew from the start, and we kind of knew this before we knew everything else, is that we wanted Donald to get what was ever left in the box after everything else was taken. Like, we always wanted him to get the short end of the stick.
Those were some of the funniest moments in the game, especially playing as Donald, to see every time he realized, oh, he almost got forgotten about again.
Yeah, yeah. And it was so fun to write that stuff because, we had the gag around the plunger, which is obviously just a classic kind of bad item to get when everyone else has got something great. But then we also had the stuff like, you know, when he just assumed he didn't need any help with swimming because he was a duck. And we got to do some gags there where we didn't directly say the words because you're a duck, but we almost had the characters treading on each other to kind of make the gag land. And he's just such a really funny character to write for.
Yeah, what was it Mickey said? We don't really talk about it anymore.
Yeah, exactly that. Yeah. And then obviously we had all the only works in text feather physics jokes when he gets handed two feathers for the flapping. And yeah, it was just... they're just such an incredible group of four characters to write for because they all have such unique personalities, but they all just combine so well. Like, they all just play off each other.
And so speaking of writing for these characters, were there any hoops they had to jump through or any unseen restrictions they had to work around when creating these specific versions of Mickey and Friends?
You know what? It was really just about being authentic. And that's all we wanted. There wasn't like a big book of rules we got given. I think that, you know, there was stuff that we really quickly discovered that was important. Like, if we're doing anything regarding voiceover, like, you know, don't give Donald gigantic monologues. You know, that's not an easy voice to do in general, let alone for large bits of information. So we tried to keep critical path information away from Donald during vocalized scenes. you know, I think the best rule I got told, and I'd never really even thought of it, was just like, there's no obscenities. There's no replacing obscenities in this world, right? You can't swap out a naughty word for a different word because that's still in the spirit of being naughty. And so that was really fun because it's quite easy as a writer, especially in the type of writing I do, it's quite easy to fall back on, you know, the classic Spy Kids shiitake mushroom style gags. And so it really pushed me to not rely on that stuff. So that was super interesting to figure out. And they're just such distinct voices. And I think I spent a lot of time at the start of the project, as did Kelsey, my writing partner, figuring out, like, how do you write for these characters? How does something sound Mickey? Like, what words is it in what order that makes a sentence sound distinctly Minnie? And getting to then see those scripts we wrote being performed by the voice actors, you know, Brett and Caitlin, who are Mickey and Minnie, just absolutely out of this world. And like Bill and Tony, who play Goofy and Donald, would have been those characters since the 80s. So like, that's my childhood Goofy, who I've always adored. Like, getting to see him in my script, that was unbelievable. And they are such, like, they're such legendary professionals. It was amazing that they'd be reading our lines and every now and then they'd maybe swap two words round. And there was just times where, like, Bill would literally do that. He'd be performing a Goofy line and he'd naturally change two words round from how I'd written it. And I'd sit there and I'd be like, that sounds 10 times more Goofy. All he's done is change those two words round and that line is 10 times more Goofy. And it's because they are those characters. Like, they know those characters. So it was just an absolute pleasure to get to work with them.
That sounds like an absolute dream come true, just to sit down with them for even just a couple hours and hear them do those voices. So did you and the team sneak in any lines that were just for you guys to hear them say as those characters?
I mean, my favorite story from all the voiceover stuff is I was remoting in. So the sessions were taking place in LA and I was remoting in from Essex, where I am in England. So it was like 2 a.m. and I was at home working from my home office, and I've got a little pug, my pug Hugo, and he likes his routine, and he was quite annoyed that I had not come to bed yet because it was so early in the morning. And he came in during Caitlin's session for Minnie and he jumped up on my lap, and Caitlin had a scream so she could see us on camera, and she saw Hugo get on my lap, and then she started talking to Hugo in character as Minnie Mouse. God. So Minnie Mouse was talking to my dog, and like, that is literally a core memory. That is not something I'm ever going to forget. But yeah, like, that was amazing. And, you know, there was just all the performers were fantastic. There was a couple of people who, like, where Deborah Wilson actually did the bird sounds for the peahen. And obviously Deborah Wilson's like, you know, this came out the same year she did a main role in Jedi Survivor. Like, and she's doing bird squawks for us, which she was unbelievable at. And then she did a very, very good impression of me, which the rest of my team who were on the call found hilarious, as she was doing her Essex accent pretending to be me. So yeah, it was all wonderful. It was all absolutely wonderful.
And so going back to the writing, it really felt like these characters were kind of like a really interesting mix of the old Disney and new Mickey and Friends, especially like it felt like inspired by the new cartoons, which sadly just recently ended. Which, have you seen the last episode yet?
I have. Steamboat Silly. It's fantastic.
Oh, it was so good. So good. Were there any specific shorts or movies that inspired these specific versions of Mickey and Friends?
Like, it sounds like a cop-out, but the actual truth is, like, the entirety of Mickey's history. So, like,
okay,
I went back at the start of this project, and like, I digested everything. I watched every short, all the features, read books. Like, I wanted to make sure that I wasn't just a Mickey fan, but like I could be, for 3 years of my life, I was like a walking encyclopedia. But tonally, the big thing for me was I love like the 30s and 40s stuff, like Lonesome Ghosts, through the Mirror, Clock Tower, like all that stuff. And it's because they were a little bit cheekier back then. You know, they're very like, it's their cheekiness has definitely come back in the Paul Ruddish stuff recently, but you know, I think that was almost the peak cheekiness back in the early days before the Playhouse Disney stuff. And so I really loved that stuff. And I always had this thing in my head whenever I discussed anything to do with the Fab Four of like, what would Lonesome Ghost have been like if Minnie was there? Because Minnie's not a party pooper, so she wouldn't have stopped it happening. She wouldn't have been treading on the fun. But Minnie is really smart. And those three dudes, when they're together, are absolute idiots. So like, the idea of like, what would it have been like if Minnie went on these adventures as well? And I found that really interesting. So I really had that in mind when I was writing for them. And we just wanted it so that it felt like Mickey. I didn't want you to watch our cutscenes and be like, oh, they've just put Mickey's visuals on a character that they've written completely new. And at the same time, I wanted it to still have a little bit of like a Dalala flair to it so that it felt, you know, oh, this feels familiar to me. It's Mickey. It's my Mickey. But this feels like a new story and like a slightly newer take on the characters.
Were there any Disney characters that you were hoping to get in this game too that you would love to have written for?
I mean, my team are always on my back about Where's Daisy. In fact, I think everyone is on my back about Where's Daisy. There's why in one of the very early cutscenes in the game, when you see the Hokans for the first time, one of them's actually wearing a shirt that's got a picture of Daisy and a question mark. And that is because it's the number one question my team always ask me. I'd love to have wrote for Daisy. I'd love to have wrote for Chip and Dale, Oswald, like a lot of the Disney, like Toontown characters. But it was always these four. Like it was never like, oh, okay, we're going to do Mickey, Minnie. What about the other two? Like that was non-negotiable for me. Like I knew that these were the four I wanted to write for. You know, I hold out hope that, you know, over the next couple of years, the game finds its audience and maybe there's, you know, maybe there's reason for us to go back and do DLC or bring some more Disney characters into the story somehow.
So are you saying there's no plans currently for DLC or even adding future online co-op or bring it to other platforms?
There's no hard plans for any stuff like that. What I will say is, and what I am allowed to say is that there is a, you know, we've still got a little team on the project at Dalala, and that team is, you know, paying close attention to the players. You know, little things like, you know, we had a player message us the other day because he's playing using a SNES-style controller and you can't navigate the map with that. And so we're kind of looking at what sort of quality life stuff we can be doing, if there's any fun little updates we could be putting into the game. So I definitely wouldn't say this is the last you've seen of us working on Illusion Island, but there's no big plans at the moment. Like I'm afraid I'm not going to be coming out anytime in the next few months and introducing a brand new Daisy 5-hour add-on for the game.
No horse add-ons either.
No horse. No Mortimer. No Clarabelle. None of that yet.
Okay. All right. Darn. And so let's go back to the game development a little bit, where like the biomes were very unique. They all felt like they stood out, but they also flowed together really well. My favorite was the water level. First water level I really liked, especially in a 2D style game. Were there any biomes that really didn't make the cut or didn't make sense, but you were thinking about at the time that you wanted to add on to?
Yeah. So, the game was originally going to be 5 biomes. And when we got to the end of pre-production, we realized it just wasn't achievable and it didn't make sense. Like, we were almost doing biomes because we loved the idea of the biomes rather than them making sense for the game. So trying to think of what ones we had. So we had a really interesting one, which was a little bit like a Halloween fun fair meets Land of the Dead. So that was a biome for a while where, like, you almost...
So like not so scary party?
Yeah, it was kind of like you went on the journey of life. Almost all the way through to death, but in a fun way, not in a deep dark way. So we had a biome for that. We had one that was a little bit of an homage to Castle or World. I can't remember which one. Which was we had like a board games biome at one point, so all made out of like weird takes on board games and things like this, and a lot of it like felt like it was. Would have been great back in Castle and World of Illusion days, but didn't necessarily fit in with what the World of Monoth that we were making. So like the three that we landed on were always, those three were always there once we'd kind of started refining what ideas we wanted. And when we came down to make the decision of cutting from 5 to 3, like it was an easy decision, which ones, like we always knew we were going to keep those three. But yeah, there was tons of ideas. There is a lot of concept art inside the Dalala archives of weird and wonderful ideas that came from our art team.
And I just got to say, making some of the collectibles being concept art as well was really, really cool to see, especially when you got the little floating orbs. I forget the name on top of my head right now.
The glimpse.
Yeah. And those slowly unlocking basically a concept art of each of the areas was really cool to see. And on the other collectibles too, where you collected some of the old memorabilia and getting the cards and having hidden Mickeys, Were there any collectibles that you were hoping to add as well? Was there any rhyme or reason for why you added those specific collectibles to the game?
Yeah, I mean, this was me getting to really take advantage of my role on the project and just picking all my favorite Mickey cartoons. So, that spread you see, that spread of kind of all the cartoons that are contained within the memorabilia, they're like all my favorite ones. And my team may say otherwise, but I like to think I don't play the I'm the boss card very often. But I definitely took advantage of it for this so that I got to include all my favorite stuff from the start through to the modern things, getting to put in Lonesome Ghosts, which, as I've mentioned, is my favorite, but going back to the older stuff and then putting in like Potato Land stuff from the modern shorts. Like, yeah, the cartoons you see are literally all my favorite ones, to the point where the number of Mickey memorabilia in the game was based off of the number of cartoons I was not willing to cut from the list, basically.
So is it safe to say that you are the Disney adult of the office?
I think there's a lot of Disney adults here. I think I am probably the I think I'm probably the one the most obsessed with Mickey and Friends. I think that the team would probably give me that one. And yeah, I mean, it's what made this so nice. Like, literally next to me, like literally just to my right, I've got my childhood Mega Drive or Genesis copy of Castle of Illusion and Quackshot. Like, the actual copy I had when I was a kid is here. And it's just really amazing to, like, I had that next to me for inspiration, but now I get to look over and see that, and then like look just to the left of that, and I get to see the box for our Mickey and Friends game. So, like, it has, this industry can be tough at times, but this has been an absolute dream come true.
And those designs that you added to the game, they felt like your own and your team's twist on those items. Like the costumes that were worn, some of the tools that were worn felt like they would fit perfectly into the universe that you guys created. And what was it like to create your own versions of Mickey and Friends for those specific designs and
Oh,
kind of build off into your own fantasies and memories?
I mean, it's amazing. Like, there's not many people in the world that have redesigned the Fab Four. Like, it's a very short list. You look at Mickey's design, even through the last 100 years, and it is not, you can probably count them on two hands. So getting to know, like, we didn't know when we signed on if we'd be doing that or not. It wasn't like a deal breaker for us. Like, we didn't say to Disney, we're only doing this if we can design them. We wondered at first if we'd have to take a certain design from a certain era, and then Disney were very much like, no, like, this is the La La game. We want to know what does the what was now known as Illusion Island, what does the Illusion Island version of these characters look like? And that was amazing, and such a lot of trust for them to give us. And so Lucy, who's our art director, was also our lead character designer, got to do, like, we got to work out what the Fab Four are for our game, and we wanted to make sure that they harked back to the stuff we loved. So, like, the white face Mickey era. We wanted to make sure they had a little bit of a modern vibe to them. But we also wanted to make sure they were designed for the type of gameplay. And that's kind of why you see the longer limbs, the bigger hands and feet for the readability for when the camera zooms out. We got to take Mickey, we got to take the classic Minnie Mouse, and rather than putting her in the polka dot dress with the heels, we put her in flats and a jumpsuit because it's what made sense for the adventure. And it was just a really incredible process, and Disney were just so supportive the whole time. And so we literally got to live out these childhood fantasies that, of kids who get to draw the Fab Four having adventures on a bit of paper, and we got to do that, except we were doing it within an entire video game.
Oh, it's so awesome. And so you mentioned before that you all have created Battletoads. You've created a property for Disney with the Fab Four. What is the next big dream property that you and your team would like to work with next?
Oh, this is the hardest question I ever get asked, because there's so many. Like, quite often myself and my leadership team here, we will like go, okay, like, let's start thinking about the next project, or we think about the next 5 years, and we're like, okay, well, I still own the company 80%, the rest is owned by friends and family, so we don't have a board of directors to report to, so we don't have to worry about what does the next 5 to 10 years look like financially. We just have to worry about what's going to be fun for us for the next 5 to 10 years. And we always end up writing a big list of all the different IP. And nowadays, I think 90% of it ends up being owned by Disney, because let's be honest, they own all the good stuff. So there's a ton of Disney stuff we'd love to do. Obviously, like, look, there's plenty of adventures we'd love to go on with the characters from Mouse Turn and Duckburg and Toontown in general. And then they've got lots of great characters in the feature films. You know, you've got all the then you've got Lucas stuff, the Marvel stuff that's there. We've had a look, you know, we've looked at stuff outside of Disney's purview as well. You know, we're at some point a few years back, we were chatting about doing maybe a Spawn game with Todd McFarlane, which, you know, would be a real departure from Mickey. And we obviously, like, we loved like Warner Brothers stuff as well. You know, we grew up with stuff like Bugs as well. So yeah, I think for us it's just about finding things, like, we just want to work on stuff we love. Like, what IP can we work with that we love, that we'll get to have a lot of fun making, and that we feel we can bring value to? Because we don't want this to be a one-way transaction where we just get to make cool stuff. We want it to be like, you know, with Battletoads and to an extent with Mickey, our real goal there was like, yes, let's get people who love these IPs to be engaged with them, but also let's bring these to a new gaming audience. Like, this, you know, nothing warms my heart more than seeing the messages we're getting of people saying like, hey, this is the first game I've completed with my daughter, and like, oh, I just played this with my kids. And that's an absolutely amazing feeling. Like, I remember and I think about regularly playing Top Gun on the NES with my dad and playing Columns with my mum, and they're like core memories for me. And the idea that we have become core memories for people because they play these are the first games they played properly with their children. Like, yeah, like that is the biggest thing we could get. And so hopefully we can just continue doing things like this and helping contribute to memories in the future.
And to build on that, I was talking to my friend before this interview, and he was saying that he's been having such a great time playing this game with his wife as just like a really fun bonding experience too. And I can't wait to do that with my wife just to get back into the game, play it again, but also to see her experience with it too. Thank you and your whole team for making such a
Oh,
really fun
thank
game that
you.
can bring the whole family together.
Well, thank you so much. Honestly, I can't truly put into words how much it means to us. And, you know, every company says they're like a family, and it's a very cliche and almost red flag thing to say nowadays. But family is the most important thing to us here at Dalala, and that is the team, and that is the team's family. And, you know, one of the playtesters who always tries our stuff is my wife. Like, my wife loves video games. Like, strangely, she's really good at stuff like Crash Bandicoot, which is an insanely difficult game. But like, she's not a hardcore gamer, so like, I will always get Harry, my wife, to kind of play our games early on, and I'll watch her play and sculpt our tutorials around how Harry engages with the game. And you know, nowadays, 11 years down the line, we've got people here who have got kids, and so seeing their kids come in and do play tests for us. In fact, like, there's a the quest in the game where you've got to find the mayor's kids, and the grunts the kids make are like staff members' kids. We went and took them into the vocal booth and got them to make like the emote sounds. So like, when you're discovering the kids, like, one of them is my niece, one of them is Ollie, one of our IT guys' sons, one of them Lincoln, our producer's sons. And so they've been able to commit their kids' voices to Disney World, basically. So
That
yeah,
is so
no,
cool. That
it's
sounds like a
yeah.
real Bluey moment too.
Yeah, it's just been awesome. It's just been absolutely wonderful.
So, one last question for you. This
Yeah,
might
sure.
make or break the entire interview. What Disney movie do you think is the most underrated, and what do you think is the most overrated?
Oh my God, are you trying to get me in trouble? Well, I can tell you the most underrated Disney movie is The Emperor's New Groove. You know,
Okay,
this
I'll
is a
allow that one. Oh, the
I
correct answer
absolutely
is Treasure Planet.
that's so this is the internal war at Dalala. This came up so much over the last 3 years. It's almost like there's a team Treasure Planet and a team Emperor's New Groove within the studio. Yeah, so you know, I'd accept that as well. I think Treasure Planet is brilliant. Some incredible well design in that as well. Oh man, most overrated. I don't know if there. Look, I don't know if there is. I am completely biased. You have to remember, I am a Disney adult. I am completely biased. I think that. Oh God, yeah. You know, I can't
Trust me,
even pick.
this question's coming from a fellow Disney adult, so
Yeah, and like, you know,
I know how hard it is to pick.
Tom will be the first to tell you that I have no problems in being too honest. Yeah, I don't know. I can like. I think the thing is, I think I'm the perfect age because when I grew up, I had this amazing back catalogue to deal with, like, you know, decades of the classic stuff, Snow White, all the princess films. And then obviously, as I've got older, Pixar's come into the mix. And then Disney Animation Studio have had like its, you know, its third renaissance. So, like, I think maybe if I had been older or younger, I would view some of the films differently. But I think because of the age I'm at, like, I don't think, can't remember really the last time I watched a Disney film and I didn't love it. I'm trying to think, at least, can I tell you? I mean, I can tell you that The Witch in Sword in the Stone used to scare the crap out of me. It may not be that I still love that film. It's definitely not overrated, but I can tell you that used to terrify me. So I watched that film far less than a lot of the others.
I had the same reaction to the Black Cauldron
Oh,
and the
terrifying.
Lich King or whatever his name, the Devil King in that movie always scared me. It even still scares me a little bit today.
Terrifying, absolutely te like absolutely terrifying. We've got Charlotte, who's our marketing and brand person at the studio. She loves a bit of the witchy stuff, and Black Cauldron's her favorite. And I was like, oh, I don't know if I've ever seen that. And she sent me some screenshots, and I was like, yeah, I have seen that, and still see that in my nightmares. Thank you for that.
Well,
But yeah.
AJ, I will take that. I'll take that as a you can't pick between your favorites. There's no, that's a Sophie's choice for
It's
you.
Sophie's choice. It's a Sophie's choice. It really is, because I'd give you an answer, and then I think in 10 minutes I'd be emailing you, being like, "No, can I take it back? I really regret my choice." Like, yeah, no, like, yeah, just say I'm an awful, awful interviewee, and I couldn't give you a good answer to that question.
No, this was so much fun. Thank you, AJ, for your time.
Oh, thank
Are you able to
you.
talk about what's next for Dalala?
As you can imagine, a wall of NDAs. No, what I can tell you is we're in a lovely pre-production on our next thing. I'm not sure when we're going to be announcing it, but you know, getting to work on a project like Illusion Island has really kind of allowed us a real level of freedom to kind of really take our time and make sure we're hitting the, you know, a good quality bar. We love Illusion Island. We feel Illusion Island really, you know, is a 10 times the progression we showed on Battletoads, and we just need to make sure that whatever comes out of the doors of Dalala next is, you know, 10 times as better than Illusion Island was. But I do promise you this, that like you can message me anytime, you can call me, and as soon as I'm ready to talk, I'll happily come back and speak to you, because we really appreciate the support you've given us. So it means a lot.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, AJ. It's been an absolute pleasure to chat with you. And
No,
thank you
thank
again for the
you.
team. Please give the team my love for creating such a really fun and really imaginative game.
Oh, well, thank you so much. Honestly, it really does mean the world to us.